我先灭着吧。嘿，
good afternoon, everybody. This is Zeke with Movement Museum. It's 2:05, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM on your radio. Movement-museum.blogspot.com on your computer. You can also find us on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter if you want. Identica is where the cool new open source one that I really, really am keen on. There's Facebook. There's all of that sort of nonsense. I have actually two dance poems today because I saw one which I really, really liked and then saw another one that I liked as much. And so I figured let's go hog wild since I haven't been reciting any of the dance poems of the week in, I don't know, a dog's age, which is somewhat frustrating, but I can live with it. This is Take Me Out to the Go-Go by Thomas Sayers Ellis. Nikita zips across stage, trailed by a troop of white-gloved one-wheelers, Killer Joes, the 12 and under crew in disguise. A sixth sense guides him beyond darkness. An inner voice says, "When, don't stop, don't stop, don't stop, I'll tell you when." A constellation of funeral homes, jumpsuits, red and white, ribbons in the sky, the total groove, a carnival of roses circling the moon. Mere call and response never knocks socks this way, lifting nicknames and dates from the faces of tombstones, and mere call and response never will. God climbs inside, asking for souls, something we weren't taught to share. And then it comes with some footnotes in case you don't know exactly what go-go is. It's a noun, to go for it. It's from early Motown, although possibly a Yoruba, a go-go. And this I'm quoting directly from the poem. A vernacular dance music unique to Washington, D.C., a nonstop live party music in which pulsing bass drum beats blend with African rhythms and sounds of timbales, cowbells, and conga drums as trumpets, trombones, saxophones, and synthesizers belt out licks from jazz, funk, and soul, punctuated by rapt greetings to the local crews and ongoing dialogue between the dance floor and the band. 2. A music dance event featuring go-go bands, generally at a community center, skating rink, or dance hall, frequented by teens and young teens hooked up in the latest casual wear. Thomas Sayers Ellis is the author of The Maverick Room, which came out in 2005, and A Chaplet Song On, which also came out in 2005. His interview with Bootsy Collins appears in Wax Poetics number 18. He lives in Brooklyn and teaches at Sarah Lawrence College and the Lesley University Low Residency Creative Writing Program. Quite cool. I'm going to actually have to track down his interview with Bootsy Collins because that's rather nice. And yes, I think it has succeeded in calming me right down, although the Chopin as well. This is the stuff you're hearing in the background is Janina Fialskowska, which is she's doing a Chopin recital. And so, yeah, we're going to have all of that tinkly piano stuff in the background for the show. Speaking of the show, we have part 4 of the Trisha Brown interview. There is a startup with a new thing from Sequiest. Back in June, they had this whole dance and music week, and we've previously run the, what was it, the roundtable discussion that they had. And this time, they did just, on the 18th of June, they had Isabel van Grimde. I assume I'm pronouncing her name incorrectly. It's G-R-I-M-D-E. And Dominic Port talking about creating stuff with dance. I'm going to chop it up probably into about 3 parts or something like that, because this first one is, longer than normal. And it's MC'd, hosted by Daniel Denoyer. And, yeah. Bien sûr que leurs signatures chorégraphiques respectives soient fort différentes, les chorégraphes Isabel van Grimde et Dominic Port ont une en commun d'avoir intégré la présence d'ensembles de musique à leur création. Elles ont également invité des compositeurs du premier plan en danse à interpréter leur musique sur scène. Elles nous font partie de l'impact de ces associations sur le développement de leurs œuvres. So why don't we give a listen to part 1.
Alors, je me présente, mon nom est Daniel Desnoyers. Je suis membre de Sequiest Centre chorégraphique et je vous souhaite la bienvenue dans nos espaces. J'ai l'impression que je connais tout le monde. Je vais probablement un peu déformaliser la rencontre parce qu'on se connaît tous. Peut-être qu'on va aller dans le vif du sujet d'une certaine façon. J'aimerais vous présenter Isabel van Grim à ma gauche et Dominique Port ici à ma droite. Dominique et Isabelle sont deux chorégraphes qui ont été réunis pour des raisons à la fois, des raisons précises, parce qu'elles partagent tout en ayant un travail extrêmement différent, tout en ayant chacun une signature, très différente. Elles partagent un champ d'intérêt qui n'est pas seulement leur expérience avec la musique, mais aussi l'intégration des musiciens sur scène. Elles partagent aussi de longues et très fructueuses collaborations avec des artistes qui sont d'ailleurs parmi nous ce soir. Je pense à Laurent Masley pour Dominique Bond et je pense à Karine Passage pour Isabel van Grim. Et je trouvais intéressant de les réunir ensemble pour qu'on puisse parler de cette relation avec la musique, mais de parler d'un point de vue très spécifique. En début de semaine, la semaine dernière, on a eu une table ronde où on abordait l'espace qu'occupait la musique dans la dramaturgie en danse. On a parlé aussi de l'enseignement de la musique auprès des danseurs. On a parlé de la complexité des collaborations en danse, de la collaboration principalement auprès de compositeurs en danse. Et il y a un aspect dont on a très peu parlé finalement, c'est cette intégration de musique déjà existante, l'intégration de compositions originales qui vont parfois côtoyer aussi des œuvres de répertoire. Donc, je trouvais ça fort intéressant d'entendre ces deux personnes qui partagent ce champ d'intérêt. Est-ce que j'ai besoin de parler de leur biographie? J'y vais. Est-ce que j'y vais? Vous semblez tous vous connaître. C'est sûr que j'ai essayé de personnaliser quand même quelque peu leur biographie. Elles m'ont donné toutes les deux beaucoup de fil à retordre par rapport à la complexité de leur projet, la complexité des dates qui se recoupent, des titres qui se recoupent, beaucoup de fil à retordre. Je suis sûre qu'elles vont me corriger tout au long de la lecture de leur biographie. Alors, je vais rapidement. Isabelle, tu as fondé en 92 ta propre compagnie, Malgré le corps secret. Une compagnie traditionnelle de danse, c'est-à-dire une compagnie de création. Depuis cette période-là, tu as créé une quinzaine d'œuvres, dont 8 au cours des 3 dernières années, ce qui nous donne un peu une indication du niveau d'activité dans lequel tu es actuellement. On dit de tes premières œuvres qu'elles exploraient principalement les facettes plus théâtrales du corps dansant. A priori, l'ensemble de ton travail se préoccupe de 3 éléments fondamentaux, vraiment les éléments de base, le corps, l'espace, le temps. Tu lis une recherche formelle de grande sensibilité. Ton langage est très épuré, fondé sur l'étirement extrême du corps. Tu en étudies les pulsions et les tensions alimentaires. Je parlerai principalement aujourd'hui des années 2000 et plus qui apparaissent comme étant un site de création fortement ancré dans la relation entre la danse et la musique. En fait, tu orientes de plus en plus ta création vers la recherche, une recherche constante d'un nouveau dialogue avec la musique contemporaine. Au sens large, on va en reparler un peu plus tard. Il faut ajouter que parmi les collaborateurs de premier plan œuvrant au sein de ta compagnie, on retrouve le compositeur Tom Rossich, que je vous ai brièvement présenté tout à l'heure, qui assure la direction musicale de plusieurs de tes projets, puis tout en créant aussi plusieurs œuvres originales pour tes chorégraphies. À juste titre, tes œuvres sont souvent qualifiées de chorégraphie concert, c'est un très beau terme. On parle de fusion entre chair et son, d'une dimension fusionnelle entre la danse et la musique. C'est au cours de ce cycle-là que tu as annoncé une collaboration importante avec l'Ensemble contemporain de Montréal. À ton tour, tu t'es confronté à un fascinant exercice d'intégration des musiciens sur scène, tout en amorçant une réflexion sur le pouvoir de la musique. Et ça, c'est rare que j'entende ce terme-là. En 2005, l'année 2005 est l'année de la création d'une œuvre, je pense, très importante dans ton répertoire, Les chemins de traverse. En fait, c'est une œuvre qui se décline en plusieurs, d'où la difficulté de retracer toutes les étapes. Et je pense que la première expérience des chemins de traverse, c'était 3 soirées distinctes où la même danse rencontre 3 styles musicaux, 3 esthétiques musicales très différentes, soit le jazz contemporain, la musique contemporaine et la musique électroacoustique de Michel Frigon, le jazz contemporain de Tom Gossage. Tu pourrais nous donner un peu plus de détails sur les compositeurs impliqués. 2006, une autre création fort importante dans le parcours d'Isabelle Manville, Vortex, où les danseurs partagent la scène avec les musiciens du même, sous la direction de leur chef, Lorraine Vaillancourt. 2007, création de l'œuvre Perspective Montréal, qui s'inscrit dans un projet beaucoup plus large que tu intitules Corps en question. Tu pourras.
Là, je pense qu'il faut que je
te corrige. C'est ça, que tu ne l'as pas corrigé depuis le début.
Le corps en question, c'est un travail de recherche que j'ai amorcé en 2004 et qui sous-tend toutes les œuvres qui ont été créées depuis. C'est un travail. En fait, c'est un questionnaire que j'ai mis au point sur la perception du corps humain. J'ai interviewé des gens qui travaillent avec le corps dans le domaine des arts, la culture, la philosophie, la médecine, les sciences. Et en fait, j'ai commencé ce projet en 2004 et continue toujours. Et il a nourri en fait toutes les créations. Et je me traverse qui est en fait un concept de création qui a vu une série de créations différentes créées sous à l'aide de ce concept et les projets respectifs qui sont aussi un concept de création. Donc c'est en parallèle, je dirais.
Merci pour les questions. Et plus récemment, puis je pense que c'est un projet qui s'échelonne sur plusieurs années, de 2008 à 2011, tu es invité à créer de nouveaux projets en collaboration avec le Centre de recherche interdisciplinaire de l'Université McGill. C'est d'ailleurs dans ce cadre qu'a été créée l'une des plus récentes créations du haut pour un violoncelle et un danseur. Et depuis le début de l'an 2009, peut-être au début de la saison 2008, fin de la saison, début de la saison 2008-2009, Van Grim, corps secret, accompagné d'Isabelle, est en résidence à l'Arsenal de Metz en France. Et c'est assez remarquable, c'est une institution qui est très ancrée dans le monde de la musique. C'est pas étonnant que tu aies été choisi cette année pour à la fois y créer de nouveaux projets et établir avec le public de Metz tout un projet de sensibilisation, le public et les artistes qui œuvrent dans cette région. Dominique, c'est d'abord taillé une solide réputation en tant qu'interprète. Elle a participé à la création des premières œuvres de groupe de la compagnie Marie Chouinard et j'ajouterais que tu as profondément marqué de ta présence la création du Sanctuaire. Elle crée sa première œuvre en 93, une œuvre solo. Depuis cette période-là, se manifeste chez toi ou chez elle une étonnante frénésie créative à laquelle s'est associé le talent du compositeur Laurent Massé, qui est ici aussi, Laurent qui est là, avec qui elle travaille sur une base régulière depuis ses débuts chorégraphiques. Une relation intense avec la musique interprétée en direct sur scène caractérise aussi son approche. Sa gestuelle est à la fois abstraite et émotive. Ses thématiques puisent à différentes sources, que ce soit la littérature, la sculpture, l'univers d'un compositeur ou encore, par exemple, la calligraphie chinoise. C'est au cours de la saison 96 et 97 qu'elle crée pour la première fois une œuvre dont la musique sera interprétée par un ensemble sur scène, l'ensemble Musici, et qui interprète 6 bagatelles de Bugatti. Donc, on se retrouve sur scène et se côtoie sur scène 6 musiciens et 5 danseurs. Par la suite, Mme Véronique Lacroix, ici présente, de l'Ensemble contemporain de Montréal, lui propose de participer à une soirée hommage à John Cage. D'ailleurs, Dominique appliquera certains principes d'écriture développés par Cage à cette performance. En 2004, elle crée plus seule qu'en solo, où elle intègre à nouveau les musiciens et compositeurs Laurent Massé et Charles Trapasson sur scène. En 2006, elle collabore pour la deuxième fois avec l'Ensemble contemporain de Montréal dans le cadre d'une nouvelle création Exit. Ici, la chorégraphe doit approfondir et s'approprier les œuvres de quatre compositeurs différents. En 2007, elle crée en collaboration avec Alain Franqueur une œuvre que je dirais troublante intitulée Un homme et une femme. Les deux artistes vont à la rencontre de vocal Le château de barbe bleue de Bella Barton. Et pour terminer la présentation du travail de Dominique, elle développe actuellement un nouveau projet en collaboration toujours avec Laurent Massé et Charles Papazo. Un projet qui intègre un peu fidèle à des habitudes différentes d'esthétique musicale. Et c'est pour la première fois qu'elle intègre aussi la présence sur scène de deux chanteuses, une soprano et une chanteuse soul, Cora Legault. Alors, pendant qu'on se parle, pendant que j'ai préparé quelques questions, on va y aller un peu, puis on est tellement nombreux que je me suggère que si vous avez des questions au fur et à mesure, qu'elle vous vient, n'hésitez pas à intervenir, sinon on va être dans un contexte trop formel et ça me... Moi, la première chose que j'ai remarquée en observant quand on a préparé le séminaire dans ce musée, je me disais, ces deux femmes à Montréal qui travaillent, d'ailleurs, elles sont d'origine européenne, je ne sais pas si on va dans tous les sens, mais qui ont développé certainement un rapport particulier à la musique, mais qui ont aussi auprès d'elles des collaborateurs de premier plan. Et moi, j'aimerais bien savoir comment, En fait, peut-être je pourrais commencer par Isabelle, de céder d'abord la parole à Isabelle, pour mieux comprendre le rôle de toi, notre personne, Joseph de Dapont.
En fait, si tu te souviens, quand on a parlé un petit peu de ça, je me suis rendu compte que je commençais seulement à conscientiser son rôle d'homme Gossett. J'étais aussi mon compagnon depuis
ça, j'ai pas osé
très longtemps. Et donc, ça s'est développé de façon. Elle a commencé en tant que. Elle a commencé comme collaboration professionnelle. Donc, c'est ça qui est à la base, en fait, de notre rencontre. Et c'est très difficile de trouver exactement comment on a commencé à collaborer. Mais il y a des projets au début, quand j'ai chorégraphié, au début, j'ai d'ailleurs travaillé avec le frère de Tom, qui est compositeur également. Et bon, et j'ai été baignée dans ce milieu, toute cette famille musicale, tous les frères sont musiciens, et j'étais dans les concerts tout le temps. Et, donc forcément, il y a des choses qui se sont faites. Et les premières pièces que j'ai faites, j'ai demandé à Tom de travailler avec moi tout naturellement. Et on a fait à ce moment-là un travail qui était qui mélangeait le travail vocal, le travail de musique enregistrée, le travail vocal enregistré, le travail vocal sur scène, donc il y avait des collections entre la voix des danseurs qui chantaient, qui parlaient et leur voix qui était enregistrée. On a fait toutes sortes d'expérimentations comme ça au début de notre collaboration, entre autres. Et puis, pour toutes sortes de raisons, j'ai commencé à travailler avec d'autres compositeurs et parfois avec de la musique enregistrée, puis je me rends compte que Tom a toujours été là pour me suggérer certains choix, et quand je travaillais avec d'autres compositeurs, pour m'aider à résoudre en fait cette relation qui est difficile en fait, pour laquelle on n'est pas vraiment outillé. Il y a mille et une façons de travailler avec un compositeur, et il y a mille et une façons de se confronter avec des musiques déjà écrites. Et je me rends compte que Tom a été là tout le long, pour, même quand ce n'était pas lui qui était compositeur, pour élargir mes horizons, en fait, et puis être un peu un œil extérieur aussi sur la façon de gérer ces problématiques de travail, la façon de gérer. Et je me souviens par exemple de ma première collaboration avec un ensemble aux Pays-Bas, où on m'a imposé une musique qui était jouée par live par un ensemble, mais qui était déjà écrite. Et il y avait des passages très 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 difficiles. C'était la musique d'Anna Kuletti, une compositrice polonaise, c'était joué par un ensemble de musique allemand. C'était très très fort par moments. C'est là où on peut parler du pouvoir de la musique. Un des pouvoirs de la musique, c'est de complètement noyer ce qui se passe au niveau de la danse. Et donc, Tom m'a proposé des pistes qui étaient plutôt des pistes de position, de réduction. Si la musique était très forte, de ne pas essayer de me mesurer à cette même force, mais au contraire de prendre ça par un autre bout, puis de faire peut-être quelque chose d'extrêmement intime, qui à ce moment-là crée une dynamique qui est très forte, la dynamique qui est créée qui est très forte, et pas d'essayer de matcher, d'avoir une addition de ces deux puissances en même temps. Et ça, en fait, finalement, ça a été le départ de toute une exploration de ce type-là. Quels peuvent être ces dialogues, et de quelle façon peut-on dialoguer pour que ça soit dynamique et intéressant. Et non pas de façon à s'annuler ou à se laisser submerger. Ce travail avec Tom a évolué, maintenant on retravaille beaucoup ensemble. Et dans les projets des chemins de traverse qu'on a fait récemment en Europe, Tom est parfois compositeur, il travaille avec des musiciens différents dans chaque pays, où il est directeur musical et il supervise un petit peu le travail d'intégration de tous les compositeurs qui travaillent avec lui, comme dans le projet qu'on vient de faire. Donc c'est vraiment une collaboration artistique, même si c'est pas toujours une collaboration compositeur-chorégraphe.
Et we're back. That was, yes, Dominic Port, Isabel von Grimday, talking about music and dance. It's 2:27 in the afternoon on December 31st. And, yes, there's the music. And, yeah, you're listening to Movement Museum on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's so sort of chilly out there, but much nicer than it has been in the past, and probably will get nastier and so as the winter progresses. We're going to continue here with a, part four, the Tricia Brown interview. I quite like this one. The recording quality is just a little bit better. That echo with the Circuit S stuff is somewhat difficult to take somewhat. But yeah, here, give this a listen. Tricia Brown, she rocks.
So a lot of time on the street. So the choreographer's mind is looking at architecture because that's what's there. That's the environment, not the stage, not the studio. And I began to have these dance visions which occurred on the sides of buildings or on rooftops, etc. And that led into that whole a spate of work which was in collaboration with architecture and equipment.
What was the first one?
I remember installing some metal eyelets like this, screwing them into the wall, trying to climb up on the wall, figure out how one can do that. And it went from there to, what was the first one? Was man walking down the side of the building. Mm. Ay, ay, ay. Mm. Who would do that? Yeah. And was it a dance?
I did not see that one. Mm-hmm. But if you, there's no question that they're all dances, whether they were on from building to building or climbing the walls. I've never seen a gallery used like that since.
Yeah.
When you had climbing the walls of the gallery, that was spectacular.
Yeah.
And all of your pieces. But to me, it was fascinating to hear you talk about being the mother in Soho, where a lot of and mm-hmm. the architectural program started to be laid in, didn't it?
Yeah. I should say also it was a kind of a ghost town because it closed up. There were no boutiques or restaurants or any. There was solid warehouses, and desolate on the weekends, beautifully so, and after hours, during the week.
Were you living in a legal or illegal place?
Well, I was in the second artist co-op, which was illegal, totally. I was in the first loft we moved into when Adam was 6 months old, 1965. And the loft I live in right now still isn't legal. But a method for gaining legality was installed sometime in the early mid-70s. So this was illegal.
So this is really another case where the artist came in and changed the neighborhood, didn't it?
Yeah. Changed the economy.
And again, another case where the artists have been the first economic development team in, right?
Yeah.
So, do you remember what you did after?
After this?
Yes.
I turned to real industrial track systems, and walking outside the building was mountain climbing equipment. So I went to Camp and Trails and asked him to give me the manual and some carabiners and teach me how to do it. That was the technology for that one. And then came, I was trying to, the next one was Floor of the Forest, and initially I was trying to tunnel through fabric, installed off the ground overhead. And then that notion enlarged into creating a grid out of hemp with a pipe frame, something around 12 by 14 feet, and then threading clothing onto that hemp grid tightly, forming a tapestry of clothing, pants and dresses and shirts and sweatshirts and etc. And then giving two performers, okay, installing that at eye level in the base, in the ground floor of 80 Worcester, which was Cinematheque and a highly illegal building in which we lived in at that time. This was like the first, probably the first grant, of, you know, of in-kind grant. Giving two dancers the instruction to dress and undress their way through this horizontal clothing tapestry for about a period of 20 minutes. I was one of those dancers. And this appeared on a program with walking down the side of the building, and then there was this piece in the interior of the space, the ground floor.
And there you were, every place but in the Proscenium Theater, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Was that because you considered the Proscenium Theater as something you did not want to do, or because
no.
It wasn't attainable?
It was economic. Well, it was economic, and it was by invitation, and there were no invitations. There was the 92nd Street Y, perhaps annual program of young modern dance work, and one auditioned, and one didn't get selected.
So you were convinced you had to do it all by yourself, I mean, with French.
Well, you know, it's hard to remember this, but there were not venues for young choreographers to present their work, and there was not a tradition for a choreographer under about, 35? To present their work.
Yes.
Outside the auspices of the choreographer with whom they had been training, dancing, and associated. So the fact that we were even presenting dances outside of the composition class was really not a possibility before Judson.
Now in Judson, you were working together, you said you were working in a democratic way and making these decisions, whoever wanted to perform could perform. Did that last? What happened?
Well, the combination of the pitfalls of altruism and the territorialization of those who were had a strong direction for their work. So it went from an experimental pool of people. It launched certain choreographers and it burdened others.
And how did were you burdened?
Well, I had the ambition of the more advanced members of Judson and the circumstances for working that out were not available to me economically. Domestically,
And so you chose to do what?
I worked at my pace as I could through the second half of the 60s. And then I reached a point where I couldn't go on doing these, in fact, dangerous dances without support. And I didn't know what to call this area, since it this area of this hybrid of performance, dance, and sculpture, or whatever. We didn't have performance art yet. There was no category of support for me. So I decided to go back into that elegant form called dance, which I had been trained in, and to approach it through this immense bath I'd just taken in contemporary art. And I include music when I say that. I don't mean the visual arts only. And to find my way, find my language in dance, which again took me another half a decade to externalize the way I dance and make it an option for other human beings to do, since I have my personality embraces elusive behavior and didn't want to be pinned down to a technique or use anyone else's, because I didn't think that was like what a creative person should do, that they should make their own. And so I invited a few people to join me in a company. I didn't have any money to pay them, or very little to pay them, and to begin making a formal, in the 70s, in 1970, make a formal organization and to try to develop this language movement.
From one extreme to another. It's 2:41. You're listening to Movement Museum, talking about dance on your radio. We're also talking about dance on your computer. If we're talking about dance on your radio, it's 90.3 FM CKUT here in Montreal. When we're talking about it on your computer, it's movement-museum.blogspot.com. If you want to get in touch with us, the email address is movement@ckut.ca. You can also find us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, on Identica, all over the internet. Yeah, I quite like that interview with Tricia Brown, just because she's now like hoity-toity, fancy, famous, rich, and very, very impressive. And I imagine back in the mid-60s, she was exactly the same, except she wasn't as rich, she wasn't as well known. And hearing about her ideas of how, and or not her ideas, but just the history of what she had to go through to get where she is, it gives me great strength. It's a nice thing to hear about other people and how they got to where they did, and then say, wow, maybe if I follow in their footsteps, I can do the same. Along those lines, we have an interview with Victor Quijada, the head of Rubber Band Dance, the guy who sort of founded it, figured it out, and is doing all sorts of stuff with it. Yeah, this is my repeat for the season, where it seems that everybody is dealing with going, okay, we're going to sort of do the best of 2009 or something like that. This is an interview that I am extremely pleased with how it worked out and everything like that. It aired back in April, and so if you heard it originally in April, I apologize for playing it a second time. If you haven't, then give it a listen now.
I'm a real good Mexican food cook, what can I edit? Even if I talk really fast, man, it's not gonna happen. I don't know, maybe 3 years. It wasn't. We had gone to see The Departed with a friend, and she's a big dance fan, and she said, do you think that dance could make somebody feel all the things that, like, a film can make you feel? And I said, well, you know, I don't know. A film has words, it has text, it has a lot more tools than dance to really put you in a context and make you understand so that you can, I don't know, form more opinions. And but I think that question might have been the lighting of the fuse that went towards AV Input Output and eventually Punto Ciego. I think that's the biggest part, is the non-linear take on it. You get to know a person, their story, you feel for them, and then not necessarily from that same time period, but maybe from another time period, you'll come forward into a story from somebody else's point of view. You understand historical references, you understand personal choices, and why maybe through the eyes of one person somebody is a monster, but through the monster's eyes there you find compassion, and you find everyone is a human being with feelings and with their own reasons for everything. Rubber Band Dance Group, a lot of the work was more, I think, aesthetically was more towards the spectrum of street dance vernacular. And as I've moved on and explored and continued to push myself choreographically, compositionally, and theatrically as well, I found myself working with dancers that have more formal training. Finding dancers that understood the best of both worlds was, from the beginning, not a very easy task. That's part of the process as well, is trying to find the right cast. And it influences very much what the work is going to be. I think the more experience that someone has, the better. Taking someone that's only been exposed to the very classical, the most classical, is going to have a very, very difficult time. And having someone that's only, like, doing foundation, fundamental b-boying, and has not really exposed or opened themselves up to anything else, is going to have a really, really hard time. Usually I'm kind of an extremist, where I move from one side of the spectrum to another, and that's part of this tendency for me. And so you see the company now is very,
yeah, street level. Oi, oi, yeah, that's it right there.
In the very beginning, I was very much against big proscenium houses. I was alternative venues or site-specific or no, like, just anywhere. I'm going to try to figure out how to take what I've learned from all those experiments where, you know, I've said, okay, there are no seats, everybody's in the space, and the dance is going to be happening around them. I was always trying to recreate this feeling of what dance was to me as a younger person in the clubs, where it was happening behind you, in front of you, you were next to go in. How do you transfer some of those things to a proscenium theater where everyone's sitting down and you're not necessarily going to be dancing behind them? I was working on building my craft as a dance maker, so no lights, no production, no costumes, no nothing. Maybe some music, and let's just push play, and I'm gonna see how much I can accomplish through just movement. So what would happen is that when we're going on tour, all that site-specific work, it would be lost. The reality of us here is Cinquième Salle, is Using C, is smaller theaters. But the reality for us on tour is Maisonneuve. Punto Ciego was conceived for a proscenium house of 800 to 1,000 seats. There's that cross-pollination of techniques, which I think I may be the only, or one of the, I'm one of the only ones that are directing a company that have had that profound experience in both ends of the spectrum. In Montreal, there's a very big buzz about this now. What is different about me is how far I went from one end to the other, and how I've been focusing on trying to transmit that and build that. But I'm not the only one. But as far as putting hip-hop on stage, which is a new genre of performance, I'm not the only one. Rennie Harris, Doug Alkins, the Solid State Girls, Destin Croise, companies like Kafig, choreographers like Frank DeLuise, Company Revolution, Rennie Harris, Doug Alkins, the Solid State Girls, Destin Croise, companies like Kafig, choreographers like Frank DeLuise, Company Revolution. What I was trying to build with Rubber Band was very unique, and the language that I was going to be dealing with was a very specific language that combined what I thought was the best of two worlds. You might have an easier time to learn the Rubber Band language if you have some types of experience. The language that I've been developing has been through my body, and since 2002 has been through the body of Anne Plamondon as well. When we have a new dancer come in, that's a new language that they need to learn. Choreographing quite a lot, and what I mean by that choreographing, I mean like making steps and teaching steps. And I think it's important to make that distinction. I think right now choreographer means anything. However, as the dancers become more and more and more fluent in the language that we're speaking on this planet, then there's more freedom, and they can start to really be a collaborative process. So with Anne, it's a very collaborative process, and our starting off points are choreographic situations, not necessarily choreography or improvisational textures, and this is what we're going to do. And that's also pushing me to go further. So however, it's really important that the people that I'm working with are fluent in the language that we're working on, or else we won't have an identity. over the past 6 years, it's been about how to learn more about the craft and how to make dances and make pieces, make events that make sense. And that, I mean, I'm just constantly learning about pacing, about composition, about what transfers and what doesn't transmit to the audience. Everything that we've researched over the past 6-7 years, it's there in Punto Ciego. It's rediscovered, reinvented, re-explored. The layers of what we've discovered, we've gone further and further into those things. And I think that this is really the first time that I've been able to put all of those discoveries together in such a cohesive place. The stuff that I cut out is great stuff. There's a few experiments in there that really, really work, but have been cut out because of time, because of pacing. I think there's a lot of successful experiments in that. What can I edit? What doesn't advance the story along? What doesn't advance the experience along? Now bringing it here in its, what I feel is its most finished state as a work in progress. Everything's being taught now in studios. So that means someone that's taking a ballet class can also be taking a hip-hop class. And that wasn't the case when I was growing up. And I've seen, you know, a lot of people from both sides of the spectrum, maybe, I don't know, taking a superficial approach. I think, ideas are there in the atmosphere, you know, and we're all pulling out from the same source. I think there's been many attempts at trying to either overlap them or layer them or fuse them for a long time. Everyone, consciously or unconsciously, has known that there's this big potential for something more to happen with the elements that are there now. The next generation is not going to be putting it together superficially. They're going to be putting it together because that's what their bodies know, and that's the information that they can draw upon from deep within. And that's so exciting.
Hand me down my walking cane, hand me down my hat. Hurry now and don't be late, cause we ain't got
time
to
chat. Like?
I really wish I saw the show now. Oh, man.
It will come back.
Howdy. That voice you heard was Finn, who used to be one of the collaborators here, one of the co-hosts, one of the guiding voices behind Movement Museum, which is what you're listening to now. It's 2:57. We're almost out of airtime, out of stage space, out of track, what have you, however you want to call it. My name is Zeke. It's, as I said, 2:57. You're listening to Movement Museum on CKUT 90.3 FM. It's also 91.7 on your cable radio. If you have Videotron, you can also find us on the internet at movement-museum.blogspot.com. You can email us at movement@ckut.ca. You can Facebook us. You can Identica us. You can Twitter us. You can do just about anything you want with us, because all we do is talk about dance in Montreal on the radio. As I said, I have a second dance poem of the week. This one, yeah, and coming across stuff doing the research, I said, whoa, this is wicked cool. This is called Retired Ballerinas, Central Park West, and it's by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Retired ballerinas on winter afternoons, walking their dogs in Central Park West, where their cats on leashes, the cats themselves old high wire artists. The ballerinas leap and pirouette through Columbus Circle, while winos on park benches, laid back like drunken Gudenovs, hear the taxis trumpet together like horsemen of the apocalypse in the dusk of the gods. It is the final witching hour, when swains are full of swan songs and all return through the dark dusk to their bright cells in glass high-rises, or sit down to oval cigarettes and cakes in the Russian tea room, or climb four flights to back rooms in West Side brownstones, where faded playbill photos fall peeling from their frames like last year's autumn leaves. And that's from These Are My Rivers by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. It was written in 1981, published in 1981. And the thing that surprised me most is that I didn't realize Lawrence Ferlinghetti was a really old guy. He was born in 1919, which makes him a total of, if my math is good here, 90 years old. And if you don't know who he is, as a poet, playwright, publisher, and spokesman, Lawrence Ferlinghetti helped to spark the San Francisco literary renaissance of the 1950s and the subsequent beat movement. Ferlinghetti was one of a group of writers labeled the Beat Generation who felt strongly that art should be accessible to all people, not just a handful of highly educated intellectuals. His career has been marked by constant challenges to the status quo in art. His poetry engages readers, defies popular political movements, and reflects the influence of American idiom in modern jazz. In Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Poet at Large, Larry Smith noted that the author writes truly memorable poetry, poems that lodge themselves in the consciousness of the reader and generate awareness and change, and his writing sings with the sad and comic music of the streets. Cool. It's 3:00, straight up. As I said, thanks for listening. This has been Zeke for Movement Museum. We will speak to you next week. Same dance time, same jet dance channel or something like that. Take care.
Hey!
Through the night.